Chapter 5. Reichenbach and Sons. As they hurry down Baker Street, John tries once again to remind Holmes that Missy told him to take it easy. But Holmes doesn't appear to be listening, and it's all John can do to keep up with him. Holmes has more energy and longer legs, and as for John, the stray bullet that he took at Maiwand during his time in Afghanistan has left him, if not crippled, then at least disadvantaged. Whenever he tries to run, he receives a painful reminder that those days are behind him, and before he's even reached the end of the street, he's like an old croc, wincing with every step. To his relief, a dog cart goes by in their direction, so John hails it and climbs in. Holmes sees what he's doing and clambers up beside the driver, who seems very pleased to meet him. The two men immediately engage in a conversation which John can't hear over the rumbling of the wheels and the clatter of the hooves. He can't help feeling left out. 15 minutes later, they are dropped off at the south side of Westminster Bridge, and although Holmes and the driver are clearly best friends, it is John who is left to pay.
"What's he on?"
the driver asks, cheerfully, referring to Holmes.
"My nerves," John replies.
He hands over a few coins, almost the last of his reserves, and, moving as fast as he can, hurries to join Holmes on the Thames path. Holmes is already absorbed in his surroundings. "The last snowy day was April," he mutters as John catches him up. He's standing with his hands in his pockets, looking downriver towards the tower. "Our driver told me that just now. He remembered because he got such bad chilblains he couldn't hold the reins."
"Poor chap," John mutters, feeling no pity for him at all.
"We're talking about April last year."
"Okay, so your memory of snow was from then or before?"
"No, you said the shoes the children carried away looked new. If I'd had them all that time ago, they'd have been showing more wear by now. Take me to the place where you found me." They walk west, shielding their eyes against the dull orange sun, on its way down, even though it's only a few minutes past 4 o'clock. The river is low today, the stony foreshore like diseased teeth exposed by shrinking gums. Mudlarks pick their way between chunks of masonry and lethal-looking cages of rusted metal. The Thames mud looks more toxic than ever, its evil substrate concentrated over millennia.
"Here," John says when they reach the spot by the steps. "You are lying just here."
He sits on the steps, trying to work out the impulse that brought him here that night. He remembers the voice of Holy Peter's, the cold, the decision to take a shortcut against all advice. It's strange, he realizes, how a decision taken with no particular thought can throw your life off course. He no longer has a job. He is caught up in an adventure he doesn't understand. Just 48 hours have passed, and nothing is the same. Meanwhile, Holmes paces back and forth, charting some mysterious course only he can imagine, sometimes crouching to examine minutely the paving stones, sometimes gazing directly up into the lowering sky, looking west down the river, looking east, closing his eyes just to listen, holding a finger up to the wind. At last, after the passage of an hour or so, when John is so cold that he can't feel anything below the neck and the sun has started to sink behind the buildings to the west, he stops and remains motionless, hands resting on the stone top of the wall. His shoulders are slumped, defeated. It is as John has expected. The excursion has been a waste of time.
"Oh well," John says, getting to his feet.
"As you said, it was worth a try. Missy will be getting up soon anyway, and she'll worry if they aren't there." But Holmes doesn't move. His attention seems to be focused on his left hand, and now he lifts it from the wall and brings it close to his face. He turns slowly, still staring at his fingertips.
"Do you have a knife, Watson?"
"A small one. Why?" John looks around uneasily. "They're about to be attacked a second time." Holmes twitches his fingers imperiously, so John hands over the army-issue penknife he uses as a keyring. But his apprehension is unwarranted, because Holmes merely sets about using the tip of the knife to pick his nails. "If you're done, can we go?" he says, irritably. "Is this really the time for a manicure? It's bloody freezing." Holmes ignores him. He has managed to extract a crescent-shaped slither of something white, which he now proceeds to rub to a powder between his thumb and forefinger. He displays the results to John.
Look. No thanks. He raises his finger to his mouth and John reaches out to stop him, but he's too late. Holmes rubs the powder under his gum.
For God's sake, what are you doing?
Seeing if it's a drug or poison.
Oh, and that's definitely the best way to find out.
The amount is minuscule, I can barely taste it. He stands very still, head cocked. Then he smiles.
What?
It wasn't snow drifting around me. It was flour.
Flour? In April. Well, that makes sense.
Maybe you're a baker, John says, and someone caught you cutting the bread with sawdust. They hit you on the head and threw you in the river, and now they buy their croissants elsewhere. How wonderful it would be if it turned out to be as simple as that. If Sherlock Holmes turned out to be just a humble grifter. No, it was cold, I remember that. Bakeries are warm and they smell of bread. This place smelled of... He closes his eyes and inhales.
Metal and machine grease.
He opens his eyes.
I was in a factory. A mill. A flour mill on the bank of the river east of Westminster. There can't be that many, surely.
Not in Westminster, no. Holmes looks down the river.
But maybe further east.
Holmes, really? How much money do you have? A huddle of lighters are bobbing on the water, not so far away, in the sheltered spot between Westminster Pier and the embankment wall. Who would ever have thought that London would see such people again in the 21st century? But of course the River Thames has become the fastest and safest way to cross from one part of the city to the other. And nobody would be able to afford a motorboat, even if they were in plentiful supply. The police have a small fleet. There's a ferry that plies a trade between Tower Bridge and Kew. Otherwise, Londoners must rely on the power of the oar. The pilots are generally old, bearded, wearing fishermen's jerseys that have partly unravelled and hang off their muscular shoulders and chests. They have weathered faces and suspicious eyes. They hold up their lanterns and examine Holmes as he marches up to them.
We need to go downriver, Holmes calls out. We'll pay well.
John rolls his eyes. Great.
Which of you is the best rower?
The men smile amongst themselves. The fact is that they like a challenge.
How far?
One calls out.
I don't know. We're looking for a flour mill.
There's a few over St. Catherine's Docks way, says another, tipping back the brim of his rain hat.
His long legs sprawl halfway down the barge, and the collar of his Macintosh strains around his neck.
Silvertown, Spillers, Vernon and Sons.
Ring any bells? John murmurs.
I don't know, perhaps. He addresses the man who has just spoken.
How much to get us there in the next 20 minutes?
5 shillings.
Outrageous, we'll pay you 2, 3,
and I'm ripping myself off.
Very well, but you must wait for us and bring us back.
Watson slips a hand into his pocket and is relieved to feel coins that must surely add up to the price that has been agreed. He climbs into the rickety barge.
The lighterman expertly steers them out of the little harbour into the fast-flowing current, and the tide snatches them, sending them hurtling downriver.
John clings on as best as he can with hands already numb with cold, but Holmes's face is turned into the wind, and his eyes glow amber in the lantern light.
As they leave the lights of St. Thomas's Hospital behind them, John thinks of Missy. What will happen if she wakes up and finds the two of them gone? Will she be worried, or even angry?
Will she have faith in John's ability to look after their patient? No matter what her reaction, he knows that he's letting her down.
How did he let Holmes talk him into this?
Holmes chose well. The lighterman's huge shoulders, working with the flowing tide, carry them along at an exhilarating speed. The city flashes by, windows aglow, roofs lit by a full moon now rising in the east. Each bridge is a thrill as the pilot strains against the current whirling around the supports. As they come level with Bankside Power Station, John can hear the thundering of the great turbine. A curling ribbon of white smoke pours from the single chimney, obscuring the stars that are flickering into view as the sky darkens to indigo. The sound is soon displaced as they reach the Globe Theatre, which seldom plays Shakespeare nowadays. Modern farces and comedies are more popular, and there must be one on now. As they pass, John hears laughter and applause from the crowd.
Over the stink of the river comes the pungent smell of hot pies and pastries from the street vendors. The glass steeples of the City of London beyond catch the moonlight and reflect it back as 1,000 white eyes. There are lights on in the Shard. One business brave or foolish enough to maintain its offices in London. The tower comes into view next, torches flaming along the curtain wall, but Holmes pays no attention to the city's theatrics. He just sits ramrod straight in the prow of the barge, gazing directly ahead. When they pass beneath the huge black shadow of Tower Bridge, the lighterman has to fight against the current to keep the fragile vessel on course. The river wants to drag them down, roll them and break them and drown them, but the pilot is too old a hand to let it have its way. After a brief struggle, they break free and emerge the other side. St. Catherine's Docks is red-lit and pouring smoke, like the entrance to hell. This is where the heavy industry is to be found, out here on the edge of town, and John can make out the shadowy forms of huge barges moving up and down, transporting rusty containers and teetering piles of boxes. There are garment factories and dyers, foundries, oil refineries, mills and breweries, fish processing plants. The faceless slabs of the buildings are like huge gravestones lining the river's bank, occasionally illuminated by gouts of flame or cascades of sparks. This part of London never sleeps. Its industry continues throughout the night, and soon John's skull is aching with the metallic clang of hammers, the squeal of cutters and grinders, the hiss of steam, and beneath it all, the endless hum and whir of machinery. Acrid-smelling smoke stings his nostrils and makes his eyes stream. Sparks explode in the darkness. A saw screams as it slices through metal. He hears shouting. It's like being trapped inside a terrible dream.
There's Vernon and Sons. The pilot is pointing to a stepped red brick building on the south bank.
Through the rows of piggy-eyed round windows, John can make out the bustle of human and mechanical activities. The wharf below is alive with activities. Flower bags are loaded onto boats. Holmes shakes his head. Those windows are too small to fall from, and the roof is set back. The lighterman rows on.
That one's Spillers.
This small enterprise is made up of three conjoined buildings, each capped with a steeply pitched roof as black and pointed as a witch's hat. Once again, Holmes is unconvinced.
I would remember those weird sisters, he murmurs.
Silvertown's the one next door.
The mill is set back a little, but looks more promising. An H-shaped construction of yellow brick, with rows of large windows. Its employees, labourers or prisoners, are busily unloading grain sacks from a barge docked at the jetty.
Holmes?
John wonders if this is the place they're looking for. Holmes is staring intensely at the building as if it means something to him. Then he shakes his head. If I'd fallen from there, I'd have broken all my bones on the concrete. I've never been here before.
Are you sure? John says, a little desperate. You may have been confused or disorientated.
I'm sure.
Are there any others?
John turns to the lighterman who has taken the opportunity to roll a cigarette.
Further east, perhaps.
No, Holmes says. I could see the bridge.
John sighs.
Okay, well, there's nothing else around here. I'm sorry, Holmes, but I think your mind was playing tricks on you. Let's call it a night. Secretly, there's a part of him that's pleased. At least they can go home now. The pilot licks the paper seal, tucks the fag between his lips and lights up.
There's always Reichenbach and Sons, he says.
Holmes leans forward. Reichenbach?
Used to be the busiest flour mill in this part of London, and my dad was a waterman. But that was long ago. There's nothing there anymore, just a ruin.
Holmes's pupils are silver in the moonlight.
Where?
At first, John can't make out what the lighterman is pointing at. It just seems like a gap in the snaggle-toothed grin of the north bank. But as they row towards it, the square of darkness gradually resolves itself into a vast tombstone of a building, silhouetted black against the darkening sky. There is not a single light in any of the windows, and its shadow pools like oil across the water.
Why did it close?
John says, his voice raised above the lapping of the waves.
They were caught cutting the flower with ground-up bones. They dug them up from the cemeteries. A lot of people got sick.
I'm not surprised, Holmes says. The bones in London cemeteries are still infected with bubonic plague.
But there's an edge to his usual laconic tone, and his eyes are fixed on the lightless buildings.
Row us over to the bank, if you don't mind.
They pull up to a ruined jetty in the process of rotting into the water. The planks are slimy and pulpy, and when the pilot tries to tie up, the rope cuts straight through one of the struts. They watch as the whole edifice quietly subsides into the river with a stream of evil-smelling bubbles. A little further along, a rusting ladder is bolted to the wall.
Will you wait? John says, handing over the fare as the lighterman ropes the vessel to the rusting rungs and Holmes climbs up onto dry land.
The man looks around him uneasily.
How long?
I don't know. Half an hour, maybe? The man peers over the gunwales. His wavering face is reflected up at him from the black water.
Half an hour. No longer. Then I'm off.
Thalassophobia, Holmes says, as John clambers up to join him.
Fear of deep bodies of water. It's that impenetrable blackness they don't like. A feeling of being watched by things squirming beneath the surface.
Alternatively, it's the smell and the noise and the cold and the fact that he probably wants to go home to his family.
John returns.
As they make their way carefully along the cracked concrete walkway that leads to the factory entrance, the face of the moon follows them across the building's remaining windows. The walkway is narrow. The mill has been built directly over the river for ease of loading and unloading.
Could you fall from a window and end up in the water?
John looks up. There's an opening in the upper floor, a crane protruding from the brickwork next to it. This must have been how the flower was taken down to the boats waiting below. Along the parapet above the crane, the words Reichenbach and Sons are spelled out in human-sized red letters that just about cling to their corroded struts. The eye has partially detached and dangles treacherously, ready to spear someone walking below. They get to the entrance doors, but there is no way they're going to open. They have been chained shut.
You observe the lock and the chains, Holmes mutters.
I do, and I deduce there's no way through.
The factory is old, the chains are new. That should tell you something.
Holmes looks through the darkness.
The doors at the back are open, he says.
John chuckles.
And how do you deduce that?
I don't.
I remember.
Their eyes meet for a moment, and John feels a surge of excitement mixed with unease. What else is Holmes going to recall tonight? Will they find the answers to their questions? Or at least to the most important one? Who is Sherlock Holmes?
And there's another, more important question playing on John's mind. Somebody wanted Sherlock Holmes dead. Why? What had he done to make himself a target? And can he be sure that the building is empty? Is it possible that his mysterious enemies are still here? The two men pick their way down the side of the building, over broken glass and rusting machine parts, emerging in a forecourt where huge grain silos stand sentinel, like the monoliths of some abandoned civilization.
Follow me, Holmes murmurs, and John does as he's told, arriving at a doorway set deep into the wall.
It's exactly as Holmes said. The door is ajar, and stale, ice-cold air breathes from the crack.
John swallows hard.
There's an atmosphere of menace about the place that Holmes must feel too, because he makes no move to go inside. He just stands there, one palm resting on the blank face of the door, as if feeling for the mill's heartbeat. John wonders what is going on in that remarkable brain of his. Does he actually want to discover his identity? Or might he be tempted to take the rare opportunity that has been offered to him? A completely new start, the sins of the past forgotten. Would it not be more sensible to ignore the yawning darkness on the other side of the door and simply turn round, go back to the lighterman, and have him return them to Baker Street, to the warmth of the range and of Missy's presence, to companionship and peace? For a brief moment, John sees an alternative future, an evening spent around the kitchen table at Baker Street as Holmes reads his periodical and Missy prepares supper. Or perhaps John will cook dinner for them all, one of the recipes he picked up in Helmand, kabuli pilaf, with toasted nuts and... A scream of metal against concrete hurls a flock of pigeons up from one of the sightless windows. Holmes has pulled open the heavy metal door and stepped inside.
Pause to allow for retinal adjustment. Odours, dust, industrial lubricant, rodent droppings, wood smoke. The latter just a trace, probably the cooking fire of a rough sleeper now departed. Sounds, moaning of wind, creaking of unstable structures deeper in the building, scrabbling and rustling of rodents, Watson's footsteps behind me and then his heavy breaths at my shoulder. I have been here before.
But when? And why?
Look. Look around you. Try to remember.
Slowly, the room takes shape. Rows of cuboid metal vats connected by pipes and tubes laid out in broad aisles. Hoppers beneath the vats contain traces of wheat chaff and a few stones.
I move down the first aisle, my feet rasping over husks. Watson follows.
Do you know this place?
I'm not sure.
I cannot tell him.
Not until I know myself. I need more information.
Why would I come to a place such as this? Was I looking for something? No, I was not an investigator.
That is not what I was or what I am.
Why did I come here? Was it my choice, or was I brought here?
I walk on. A breeze through the broken windows sets the old ceiling lamp swinging like pendulums. My head darts to the right. Someone is moving in the deep shadows. I stop, hoping to see them, knowing that I will recognize them.
The man who brought me here. What do you see?
Watson whispers. I raise my finger to hush him.
What do I see?
My own shadow? The lights from a passing barge? I exhale. Nothing. There is no one there, not now. But there was. He was my friend, or so I thought. He was the closest person to me on the planet, my own reflection. He told me to come here, and I came.
Holmes?
Now I walk to the end of the corridor, knowing that I will find a metal staircase tucked away around the corner, and sure enough, there it is. There. The banister under my palm is rough with flaked rust. A tingling in the nerve endings of my fingertips passes through my hand and up my wrist. The sensation is familiar. I took the staircase once before. On that night. I climbed up, eager to see him. Why here? Why would he have chosen an abandoned mill on the edge of the city? But I didn't ask that question. He had commanded me to be here, so of course I came.
Holmes, where are we going?
I reach the next floor. Cupboard-like structures are mounted on frames, some with their doors ajar, coarse grain spilling onto the concrete floor, a different smell now. The must of old flour. The sounds of the docks have receded. The cries of the lightermen are no more than the calls of distant gulls.
Why did he bring me here?
I ask myself that now, and I should have asked the same question then, and it would have been obvious to me. Had he wanted to extract information from me, or simply to punish me, there would have been no chance that he would be disturbed in his work. No witnesses. No one to hear a cry for help or mercy. Did he torture me? There is no evidence on my body. Only that final devastating blow to the head. Did he want to kill me? Was that his intention?
Holmes, do you remember anything?
Possibly. I need to see more. I walk past the cupboards. The heart of a fool would be pounding now, in terror of some killer or monster bursting from those doors. My own heart rate is elevated, but only because my senses are primed for fight or flight. Though I'm certain no one else is here, my limbic system cannot be reasoned with. But I'm wrong. I stop so suddenly, Watson gasps behind me.
Someone is here.
I saw his reflection quite clearly for a moment, in the gleaming side of one of the sifting machines.
Holmes, are you okay?
I hush him.
You don't look well. I think we should get back to the boat.
I walk on, my footsteps shushing on drifts of flour, and my pursuer keeps pace with me. I see him in the dull metal, dim phantoms that flash by or pause a moment until they have drawn my gaze before taking flight. Is he really here? Following us with the silent stealth of an assassin, or just moving through my mind?
Holmes, this is too much for you. We can come back when you're well.
Not yet. I shake Watson's hand from my arm and walk on. I reach another staircase and climb all the way to the top floor.
The moon is a searchlight pouring through these upper windows, and the wind stirs drifts of flour spilling from burst bags littering the floor. It eddies it around me like snow. I walk towards the front of the building and the huge yawning chasm at its center. The loading gates have long since fallen away, leaving a vertiginous drop to the river far below. The broken mechanism of a hydraulic crane is fixed by a bar that passes through the wall beside me. It is screwed onto a metal plate that is worn to a shining silver. My left foot makes contact with something that rolls away, clanking, a section of the crane mechanism. One end of this metal bar is ragged, where corrosion has torn it from its position. The other is stained with something dark, something that the cold moonlight has dyed purple, but in the full glare of day would be crimson. The storm behind the door in my head becomes wilder. Thunder pounds, the wood is splintering, and finally I remember. I had come to know him for what he was. I understood what he planned. I had seen the evil that coursed through him like the very blood in his veins. It was here that I made my decision. Better death than to remain in his power. I stagger, buffeted by the wind coming in through the gap, as if I am as insubstantial as the drifts of flour and might disintegrate at any moment. "Come away, Holmes!" Watson cries. "You'll fall!" Who is Sherlock Holmes? I can see my face in the mirrored plate. "You are!" Watson cries. It is my face. But this face is smiling. Mine is not. "You found me," he says. "This other me." Watson says, "Yes, I found you, Holmes. What do you mean?" But I cannot answer. The door in my head has burst open, letting the storm in, and I am falling forwards, the black serpent of the river rearing to swallow me. I stop falling, dangling out over the drop, pivoting on my heels. Watson howls with the effort of hauling me back. I am a dead weight, struck down a second time. He lowers me gently onto a pillow of flour, speaking in low tones, but his words are meaningless. There is only one word with any meaning. My jailer. My mentor. My nemesis. A name. Moriarty. The lightning strikes. Blackness.